This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Waking up with Anastasia and Warren, Joy 94.9.
He's a regular broadcaster on Triple J, does the Sleek Geeks podcast, is on BBC Radio 5 across the UK, was Father of the Year, has an asteroid named after him, I wish I did, Australian Skeptic of the Year. He's authored 40 books and was voted the ninth most trusted person in Australia. He's also received a prize for researching belly button fluff. Dr. Carl, welcome to Joy.
Dr. Warren, you're too kind. I'm all blushing and everything.
It's fantastic. I want to start with talking about science and communication. You have an amazing art to be able to turn complicated science into something so simple for everyone to understand.
I finally worked out how I could do it. It's number one, because I'm not that smart. My IQ is only 110, which is barely above average. So I'm in there with the two-thirds of the population that are between 85 and 115. And by the way, each generation is getting smarter by 9 IQ points every generation, so I'm rapidly becoming average and then below average. And the second thing is that I have 28 years of education. Thank you, Australian taxpayer, for paying for it. And the third thing is I was just lucky enough to have a bump for being able to recognise a good story, and then because I'm not very smart and I've got the good education, I can go through it and then work out, if I can understand it, then you can understand it. So my only real skill is I can say, wow, that's a good story, and then try and understand it. I'm still working on the one about the ponytail. So if you see somebody running, their overall motion, of course, is forward. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of motion up and down, you know, because they're bouncing along, but the ponytail goes side to side.
It does too.
It goes really side. The overwhelming majority of the ponytail's motion is side to side. And I was able to find in an obituary of somebody who'd done some work on it, the link to their original paper. And I read the paper and I couldn't understand it. So now I've got a real physicist working on it to try and explain it to me so that I can explain it to you. Because, for example, you know the one of why is the sky blue?
Yes.
Well, I went around and I thought, oh, that's pretty basic physics, and I'm in the school of physics, so I said,
isn't it refraction or something?
So I asked the various people and said, oh, no, that's too hard. And I spoke to all these professors thinking it was just basic physics. They said, oh, no, you got to talk to an atmospheric physicist. So I started talking to this guy, and he then started talking, and I thought, I don't understand what you're saying. I had to call in another guy, another physicist, who could then turn it into language for me. And then finally, after about 5 hours, I can now explain why the sky is blue in about 2 or 3 minutes.
Wow.
But it took that long to get there. So that's my skill, that I've got enough education to know who is the expert who can help me on the pathway to understanding it. And I'm not so smart that I just automatically get it. I have to work it out slowly and painfully.
And translate it.
And then so translate it. So if I can understand it, then you can understand it.
So you say we're getting each generation, did you say 9 IQ points per generation?
This is called the Flynn effect. It's in my 38th or 36th book, and it's called Smarter Than Your Parents. And it was discovered by a bunch of people, but Flynn is a guy who got famous for it. And it's based on the effect, on the thing that the Americans have this huge military force. They've invaded another country once every 14 months of their 240-year history. The joke is that the Americans learn geography by invading another country, and then they leave it. As a result, there have been tens of millions of people since 1932, Americans inducted into the American Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, etc., etc. And every single one since 1932 has an IQ test done on them.
Ah, so they've got good records.
They've got a huge database. And following it through, James Flynn realised that one of the standard IQ tests, the WISC, W-I-S-C, Wischler Intelligence Scale for Children, and the WAIS, W-A-I-S for adults. There's various versions. They all have to be upgraded several times a century. because the people are getting smarter. And the amount they're getting smarter by is, on average, 9 IQ points per generation. And it's not just America, because if you then look at other countries, you then find that if they can afford to do IQ tests on their kids, you can pick up this over the generations. So overall, we humans are getting smarter. We don't know why. It might be the fact that the world is getting more abstract. So if you go to a kid of 1900 and say, dog and cat, please tell me about a dog and a cat, they say the dog chases the cat, whereas today they say, well, obviously, Dr. Warren, they're both mammals, what else do you want to know about them? And also, the work that we're doing is changing. In 1900, only 3% of people had jobs where they sat down and thought. Today it's 35%. So our brains are responding to the changed environment. We're getting smarter, which is a good thing to have. So that'll help us deal with global warming, et cetera, et cetera.
One other question I've got about that. Does that mean, though, when we're looking at smartphones and you walk down the street and everyone's staring at their phone, their heads down,
yeah,
and they're just flicking, and are we... could we be counteracting the increase in IQ by our behaviour with our smartphones and our dependency on technology? For example, my car parks itself.
Oh, you got one of those.
I don't have to look over my, you know, over my shoulder, look in the rearview mirror, calculate the distance, and all of these functions aren't going on in my brain. I just press a button and adjust the accelerator. So are these things counteracting the increase?
Yes and no. There's two factors here. There's smartness and there's knowledge. I'm not particularly smart, and while I do have a lousy memory, I've written 40 books, so I have a fairly good database, because writing it down, going through the 10 to 20 hour process, locks it into your brain. So what we're finding is that many people today, some, do not even know their own phone number.
Yes. Whereas the timer used to know everyone's phone number.
Right. So that aspect of their memory is going. But then, on the other hand, their emotional IQ is rising and other IQs are rising. There's many different forms of IQ. Like there's verbal, spatial, and then there's word IQ. For example, Apple is to phone. No, sorry, that's a bad one. Apple is to hamburger as crumulent is to, I don't know, fill in the fourth word. We know the answer. It's so obvious. Audience, you can work it out yourselves. Yeah. Right, so there's all these different parts of the IQ test. And so they're picking up other things with their brains that are being rewired. So right. In no way am I scornful of it. I'm just sitting back because I'm just watching what's happening and thinking that this is working on the background of, firstly, a higher IQ, and secondly, we are living in the most peaceful time ever in the history of the human race. And these are both very encouraging signs.
So there is a plasticity to the brain where we can rewire.
Yeah, I came across this in my eighth book, where there was an interesting study done of people who were born with normal vision and normal everything else, and then due to some sort of trauma or disease became totally 100% blind. They then learnt Braille, so you feel with your fingertips, and it turned out that the part of their brain that was changing and was firing up was their now unused visual cortices. So the light, so looking at vision, light comes in through your eyeballs, lands on the retina, a layer 0.3 of a millimeter thick, then gets turned into electricity, goes to the back of your brain, gets processed. In the areas it gets processed in are called Brodmann's areas 18 and 19. It gets processed there, and then you get this full wraparound color 3D thing we call, you know, vision reality. And in the case of these people, suddenly these parts of their brain were being used to process what was coming from their fingertips and turn it into reading, whereas people who'd always been blind were using a different part of their brain. So the brain is plastic. Yeah,
that's amazing,
it can sometimes rewire itself, but it's limited because we don't fully understand the brain.
One of the other things I want to talk to you about is science can sometimes be up here and it can be quite complex to everyone in the day-to-day life. If we look at climate change, did we get too stuck up here and most of the population is at a different level of understanding with science and we needed more of people like yourself to bring it down? And did that enable climate change deniers to get in with their their scare tactics and their unproven theories and therefore manipulate the population? Is it because we were out of touch and we really needed a third space that was...
We got done like a dinner. It was a deliberate attempt by the big fossil fuel companies. It's clearly outlined in the book Merchants of Doubt. by Naomi, N-A-O-M-I, Oreskes, O-R-E-S-K-E-S. In the same way, and using the same people and the same techniques that Big Tobacco used, the climate change denialists, the fossil fuel companies, followed from the example of the tobacco companies. So the very successful technique that the tobacco companies used to deny climate, to deny any research about saying that tobacco was bad, is summed up in the four words: doubt is our product. I'll give you an example. There's somebody who's been smoking for a long time. They've, you know how much they've smoked, and they've got their genetic history and their family history and their diet, and you know all this. And so going on the big numbers, you can say there is a so many percent chance that you've got a lung cancer in you after you've been smoking for so many years. And so Professor Warren might say, well, I reckon it's 24%, and Professor Carl might say it's 22%, and the tobacco industry would say, they can't even agree. 24%, 22%. Look, they can't even agree on a single number. They're obviously just making it up. They're both wrong, and therefore smoking is good for you. And doubt is our product. They just throw doubt on it. Now, second issue. So what I'm saying is that the reason for the climate denialism, it's a specific and very well-funded campaign by Big Fossil Fuel. It sounds like conspiracy theory, but read the book Merchants of Doubt by Naomi Oreskes. Second issue. Climate science is the only branch of science that's in doubt. Yes. Nobody worries about metallurgy. If a metallurgist says, if I want to turn iron into steel, I'll add a couple of percent of carbon. And if I want to turn it into stainless steel, I'll go 18% of chrome and 8% of nickel. Nobody denies that.
But you can't agree on the percentage.
Oh, well, so right. Or if a geologist says, well, look, that's igneous, but that's over there is metamorphic. If that's what the overwhelming majority of the professional geological societies around the world say, I'll just go along with it. And if, God forbid, I've got a three-year-old child with acute lymphocytic leukemia, and I go to a pediatric oncologist who's spent 20, 30, 40 years of their life, and they say, well, look, going by what I'm seeing and what I've read, I reckon that what we need to do is start off with some steroids and some vinblastine and some asparaginase. And I don't know what they're saying, but I'll just simply say, you're the expert. I'll go with what you, and I won't simply go for what I read on the internet, and that a mixture of camel milk and activated almonds and the paleo diet will cure everything. I will go with the experts. The only field of science where you've got massive, well-coordinated attacks upon them is climate science, and it's coming directly from the fossil fuel companies. And unfortunately, in future generations, we shall pay for this, and our children shall pay for this. For example, in my latest book, I've written a story about heat waves.
Yes, I saw that.
In Victoria, in 2009, Black Saturday, 173 people die, and over twice as many die not from the flames, but from the invisible heat wave. And the way that it came to the attention of the people who would make this evaluation that these people died from a heat wave is that there was nowhere to stuff the bodies. The morgues, the refrigerated morgues were full, and they started ringing around and finding a private mortuary, a funeral parlour, a university. You got some refrigerated body bag compartments. And then they suddenly realise all these people are dying, and it's in a heat wave. And then they work out the statistics, and they look at how they died. And then they would say it's a heat wave that's killed them. And the heat waves are getting worse. So going through the numbers, 374 in Victoria in 2009 died invisibly from the heat wave, didn't make the headlines. In Europe, in Russia, 55,000 in 2011, 2003 wow. In Europe, 70,000 died. 70,000, not 7,000, 70,000 died from a heat wave. Looking at what the definition of a heat wave is, well, you get the maximum temperature for a day, say the 27th of So you get the maximum temperature for a day, which is, say, the 27th of January, and you say, okay, well, last year the maximum temperature was this, and then you go back over the 30 years from 1961 to 1990, and you look at that window of 30 years, and you work out what was the maximum temperature for January 27, then you add them all up, divide, and you got the average maximum. If you've got one day that is 5 degrees hotter, and then it's followed by another 4 days, each of which is 5 degrees hotter than the maximum temperature for that day, you call that a heat wave. That's one of the definitions of a heat wave. It's the World Meteorological Organization. There's several. That's close enough. Mm. And so in 1960, heat waves covered 1% of the land area of the planet. Beginning of this decade, 2010, 5%. In 4-3 years from now, 10%. The year 2040, 20%. In the year 2040, when you're still alive and your children will be alive, the heat waves will cover 1/5 of the Earth's surface and hundreds of thousands of people will die. And this is a direct consequence of global warming, which we knew was real in 1988.
So we know it's real.
Oh, anybody, but only because you accept the science. Like if a metallurgist says, if you want to turn iron ore into stainless steel, this is a pathway you go down. If you accept that science, you say, well, that's what all the metallurgists in the world say, I'll accept that. If you accept what all the climate scientists say, yes, we are looking at 1/5 of the Earth's surface being hit by heat waves once in each calendar year in the year 2040. And we knew this in 1988, and since then, big fossil fuel has been doing a cover-up. The documents have been found from Exxon, where they were saying, well, this global warming thing looks like it's real. Okay, bit of a backup. In 1973, the world's largest reinsurance company, Munich Re, said, oh my God, it's obvious there in the data. There's this thing called greenhouse effect, they called it then. So the different names have been greenhouse effect, global warming and climate change. The greenhouse effect is real. And in 1973, they started factoring it into their insurance premium.
1973.
The scientists need a higher burden of proof, and it took them until 1988. And so we've known it's been real for over a quarter of a century.
So whatever happened to the precautionary principle?
Well, it's not written into law, but well, we've got three examples. Let me give you three examples where accidentally big business did something bad. And let me point out, they did it accidentally. They didn't know it would happen. And the government said, wow, let's fix it. And number three, the government's fixed it. And the examples are ozone depletion. Yes. So when we invented CFCs, we had no idea that it would destroy the ozone. Acid rain, we had no idea that the sulfur in coal, when you burnt it, would combine with water in the air to make sulfuric acid and start killing fish in lakes across the northern hemisphere. And so we all the coal stacks now have sulfur scrubbers. And DDT. When DDT came out, we had no idea that DDT would weaken the eggshell of a bird so much that the chick would not survive. And when we started finding DDT in the Antarctic, we don't spray for crops for insects in the Antarctic. When we started finding it in penguins in eggshells in the Antarctic, the world government said, we're going to stop it, and we banned it, and they did. With the case of the greenhouse warming, we should have done the same pathway, but fossil fuel started a deliberate disinformation campaign. So to get back to your original question, in Australia, there's one organisation that controls 70% of the newsprint eyes. And so what they say is, oh, the debate's not in, so we give equal weight to both sides of the debate. Okay, firstly, there is no debate. The scientists have agreed. Secondly, if that's your principle, why, whenever NASA or the Europeans or the Russian or the Chinese launch a rocket into space to do something, why don't you give an equal number of column inches to the person who says the Earth is flat? In the Bible, it says that God put an alabaster dome on the planet. And then I know personally that what God does is that every night he goes up there with some black carpet and glues it in, and he puts some fireflies there to act like the stars. Why doesn't that person get equal weight to the Chinese sending up a spacecraft to set up their second space laboratory, the Tiangong-2?
Exactly.
And it's the there's only one area of scientific endeavour where the Murdoch press give what they call equal weight to both sides of the debate, and that one area is climate change. Not metallurgy, not paediatric oncology, not geology. Only one area of science will they debate.
And they don't debate it when they take a pill to fix whatever ailment they've got that's been developed by science. Or they cross the bridge that's being held up by the forces that were discovered in science.
Got no problems with engineering. No. Got no problems with architecture. There's only climate science. That's the only area of science that they choose to say that the debate's not settled. The sky is blue, climate change is real, because it's going to be bad, and the children will pay for it. For example, we're looking, if you include the positive feedback loops, of a 5 to 8 metre ocean level rise by the end of this century.
That's absolutely massive.
The wealthy places that have a big tax base, the capital cities of Australia, Sydney, Melbourne, etc., that house 60% of the population, their tax base is large enough to put up a seawall. The country towns on the water, just they can't afford the tax base to maintain a seawall that'll hold back a 5 to 8 metre rise in ocean level. And that's a cost that will not be carried by the fossil fuel companies. Here's a question for you, Dr. Warren, without any notice. Compensation was paid when slavery was outlawed in America and in London and in the United Kingdom. Here's a question. Was the compensation paid to the slaves or the slave owners?
The slave owners, I'm sure.
Right. Where is the justice in
there
that?
There is no justice in that.
So now the fossil fuel companies are asking for compensation for their loss of potential income. Where is the justice in that? There is none.
So the compensation won't go to the islands that are sinking and the people have to be relocated somewhere else because...
Well, let's just see what happens, because we're entering a new world of journalism, and I'm hoping that it turns out with better justice for all.
I hope so too. In your book, you say, I dedicate this book to the theoretical scientists. They need full and reliable funding, and definitely without the pub test. Why in this country has the pub test become the gold standard for funding? And at the same time, I hear the news and I hear about the CSIRO having to commercialise all of their projects and they have to make money. I hear about the ABC cutting funding to Catalyst and other things, and I know you can't comment on that. But in this country, we celebrate sports, we don't celebrate medical breakthroughs or scientific breakthroughs. Our whole culture has diminished it to a pub test. How did that happen here?
I am astonished. Did you know that Australia invented Wi-Fi?
Yes.
And it happened because of blue sky and supposedly totally useless research. And in 1972, John O'Sullivan was looking for black holes, couldn't find them, accidentally invented Wi-Fi. And as a result, CSIRO earned for Australia $1 billion in royalties. And then somehow we end up firing one quarter of the scientists at CSIRO. Go figure.
I can't figure it. And it actually just reminded me, as we seem to, we associate, and I have, with a science background, creativity. I've always thought, I haven't got a creative bone in my body. I can draw stick figures. And we associate creativity with the arts, which is great. But science is all about creativity, isn't it? And it's letting these things happen by chance and exploring them and coming up with all sorts of solutions. Like you said, the wormholes, the Wi-Fi, and goodness knows what else. If we have to put a cost-benefit on or a return on every single scientific investment, they almost have to know the outcome before they can justify getting funding. It just doesn't leave room for that exploratory creativity to flow.
It's a shame. In the pendulum has swung from seeing education as an investment in the future, and hence I was able to get my 28 years of education for free, to seeing it as an intolerable burden upon society. And so we've got the weird situation in Australia where the federal government gives more money to private schools than to government schools? Hang on, but aren't private schools supposed to be private and government schools funded by the government? So how come the federal government is funding private schools more than it funds government schools? And what I'm going on is this politics. In some parts of the world, power grows out of the barrel of a gun. In Australia, it grows out of politics. I'm just saying to the people go into politics. LBJ, Lyndon B. Johnson, Lyndon Baines Johnson said a very clever thing. You're better off on the inside of the tent pissing out than on the outside of the tent pissing in. So for people who are complaining about it, I say run for politics. I myself ran for politics and
that's right, 2007.
And out of the 782,000 votes that I needed to get in, I got 42,000 votes under the line, which apparently is the record. But that wasn't enough. And part of the problem was that we couldn't have enough funding. We'd have enough funding to get ads on TV. So the best we could get was a 30-second ad on Sunday morning at 3 a.m. after the abdominizer, a non-stick fry pan, but before the evangelicals. And as a result, I'm left with a big debt and didn't get into politics. But I now know you need 5 million. And what I'm saying is to people who are complaining, you're right. It is wrong. Now go into politics. Now there's a few problems with that. Number one, people will hate you. They will write lies about you. When I ran for politics, there were interviews with me where I hadn't even spoken with a person. And the second thing is there's a hard life. You'll be there at 6 o'clock in the morning at the raising of a flag at some RSL and 11 o'clock at night the same day at some high school dance. But you will have the chance to pass laws to make the future better. So I'm saying, go into politics. Power does not grow out of the barrel of a gun. And what we have is a system that's fairly entrenched. There are good people on both sides of politics, but it's not leading us to a situation where it'll be the best for our children. So when I go to vote at the local primary school on a Saturday morning, I'm not thinking of what it will do for me. I'm thinking of what will your policies do for my children and their children. And what we need is politicians who will come from the generation of today who will think for the future. Just remember this.
And not their self-interest.
Yeah, end of the century, 5 to 8 metre ocean level rise and massive heat waves, and all this brought on by fossil fuel burning. We can fix it. We can get rid of all of the carbon emitted from making electricity within 10 years. That's 50%.
Which isn't long, 10 years.
We could do it in 10 years. Well, the example I use is the 7th of December, 1941. Pearl Harbor got bombed. Within 9 months, the number of motor vehicles made for the American domestic car market was zero. They'd switched over entirely to a war footing. And we could do the same thing, and within 10 years from now, we start today, we make the political... There's nothing in a technological or scientific stopping us from going totally renewable. It's purely political. We make the decision in 10 years, our electricity is rock solid, covering baseload. And baseload power is the stuff that you need that's there 24 hours a day when times are bad, when a tsunami rolls into your city and the hell mouth opens, and not only do all the vampires come out, but also a volcano and a cyclone comes in. And then on top of that, there's an earthquake. And then on top of that, the Kardashians come to town. And under those circumstances, you need baseload electricity, and renewables can provide that within 10 years, but wait for it, at one third of the price of burning carbon. And the way you can find this out is by going to the University of Melbourne homepage. There's a subsite there called Zero Carbon Australia. Download the 2 meg document. It took me 2 hours to read. Download the 10 meg document. It took me 10 hours to read. And then after that, you'll see that the path forward is quite easy. And so we can easily go down this pathway, and it will be one third the price of burning carbon. And here's a secret, and promise not to tell anybody.
Okay.
Electricity is cheaper if your fuel is free.
Oh.
Don't tell anybody. It's a secret. It won't be
You're
cheaper.
A genius.
It won't be cheaper in the first
you are
hour.
A genius.
It won't be. It won't be cheaper in the first hour or the first week. But averaged out over 30 years, and our children will be here in 30 years. Averaged out over 30 years, it'll be cheaper, one-third the price. How can you not go down this pathway?
There's one thing I have to dispute with you, though, with what you just said, and that is the vampires won't come. Because in your book, you rule out vampires. They just, in terms of the time that they can suck the blood, I think.
Yes and no. There's a conspiracy theory here, and I'm just going to let this one out secretly as well. The best thing the vampires ever did was convince us that they weren't real. And that way we are right. Yes,
that's right. You're not a vampire, are you?
Well, I can't say. But the thing about the vampires is if they bite somebody and turn them into a vampire, then that person that they've turned into a vampire is no longer available to be bitten. And if you have the biting time between meals of 1 month, you need only 32 doublings. 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. You very rapidly get into big numbers. You need only 32 doublings. Less than 3 years where everybody in the world is a vampire. What are they going to do for dinner?
No food.
No food. Bummer.
No food whatsoever. In your book, you're talking about, you say you can't wait to see the practical uses that will come from dark energy, dark matter, and gravitational waves. What do you think will be the new big thing for this century? The electricity of this century? Is it superconductors at room temperature? What do you think it is?
Oh, that's going to be in so many different fields. So certainly, there will be stuff coming from dark matter and dark energy that we have no idea what it is. I'll give an example. 1900, they don't know what the heck is keeping the sun burning. They know the size of the sun, how far away it is. They know one of the most energetic fuels on the planet is coal. If it was made out of coal, it would have burned out within a few million years. And the geologists are saying it's 20, 30, 50 million years old. The Earth is that much old. They could not work out what was causing the sun to burn. They accidentally discovered it was radioactivity, and as a result, we got X-rays. Right. So who would have thought that trying to solve why the sun burns gives you X-rays? So there's all these other things. Dark energy will give us stuff we can't even think of. We do have to become a space-going race. We nearly got wiped out two Halloweens ago by a big rock 600 metres in diameter that missed us by the distance of the Earth to the Moon. And if it had hit, would have wiped out between 10 and 90% of the humans on Earth, and the amount of warning that we had was 3 weeks.
Wow.
And we have to become a space-going race, so we have to have fusion engines, nuclear fusion, mm-hmm. so we can scoot around the solar system at, say, 1% or 10% of the speed of light and get to Mars in 200 minutes instead of 9 months.
We may wipe ourselves out, though. It may not be an asteroid that...
That is
if we
possible.
Continue on this trajectory.
What we're doing to the, is bad, but on the other hand, we are getting smarter by 9 IQ points every generation, and stopping us from being diverted is the fact that we are living in the most peaceful time ever in the history of the human race.
Dr. Carl, can I just run through a couple of things quickly in your book?
Running through.
You talk about raw milk. Now, I used to drink gallons of the stuff because mm-hmm. I thought it was really good for bodybuilding, and I felt like it was, you know, building muscle. And after reading your book, I realized how terrible it is.
Well, it can kill you.
Yes. But what about cold pressed raw milk? Is that just a marketing ploy, or is
it depends upon what you're worried about. Okay, pasteurization. Pasteurization is five nines. It kills 99.999% of the bacteria in the milk. Milk is an excellent culture material for bacteria. They grow like crazy. So from the moment it's pasteurized, there's only a very small number of bacteria left. And they've got about 1 or 2 weeks before they get to the point where they can cause damage. So with regard to cold pressed, it turns out that if you go to enormously high pressures, and I'm talking not just commercial pressures, but very high pressures, like thousands of atmospheres, tens of thousands of atmospheres, you can do the same effect as pasteurization and kill the bacteria. Are they going to that same high level? Don't know. Do people die from and get diseases from having raw milk? Yes. It's like saying, wow, it's raining and there's this thing called an umbrella. If I use the umbrella, I won't get wet. Nah, I'll just go. I won't use it. And it's like saying, we invented this thing called pasteurization. Will I use it? Nah, I'll just die.
Okay, I won't buy it then.
But with regard to most bodybuilding, and by the way, you're looking extremely fit. By the way, for the audience who don't know, Warren is your classic inverted pyramid with a slim waist and big shoulders. I'd almost think that he was a surfer. Are you a surfer?
No, I used to be a windsurfer.
Oh, right, okay, you got that build. And so it turns out that for most of us who are not the professional bodybuilders, milk with a bit of chocolate after a workout gives you as much benefit as going with a full all the supplements.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, actually, in terms of after a gym workout, there's all different types of
creatine
proteins you can take.
Works.
So creatine works.
But it'll knock off your kidneys.
Oh, okay. So it's probably not worth it then.
There's a guy I know who's actually at a very high level with his pumping iron, and his kidneys, he's had a creatinine test, which is not creatine, and he's unwell. He's at the racehorse stage. He's now been putting on 1.5 kilograms per week, and now he's stripping down to come down to the 4 or 5% fat, and he's picking up infections like crazy. He actually got admitted to hospital with a flu that in you and me, with our better immune systems, we would have knocked off. But he's pushing himself so hard,
right,
like a racehorse, that he's very fragile. And I know GPs who have patients who are bodybuilders, and when they're getting down to the 5 or 6% stage, they go into the shower, they turn on the hot water, the blood vessels in their skin dilates, and their body can't respond fast enough to close down the blood vessels, and they faint in the shower and turn up and to be, get stitches.
Because of blood pressure drops.
Yeah, quickly. Because going for extreme bodybuilding is like any extreme sport. You're not healthier. You're less than healthy, but you're going to look really good, or you're going to be a really fast runner, but you're not. Your immune system sucks.
So everyone out there, milk and chocolate is the way to build muscle.
For the average person.
For the average person.
And avoid, wait for it, antioxidants.
Oh, really?
You know how they say oxidants, whatever they are bad for you, and therefore antioxidants are good?
Aren't they meant to mop up the free radicals or something?
Yeah, it's so complicated. And it turns out that if you get somebody to pump iron, and then the same as you got the pumping iron, you got the trainer, you got the diet, but if you get them to take antioxidants from a tablet immediately after each pumping iron session, they won't put on the muscle.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What they lied to you. What if you have a multivitamin before?
In general, no, you don't need multivitamins, and they can be bad for you. There's a whole history to why multivitamins are bad for you, but let's not slow things down.
You also talk about dogs tilting heads. Now, I've got a dog, a little poodle. His name's Fuzzy Bear. Mm-hmm. He's 9 years old. I'm sure I can talk to him and he understands.
And?
I know when he's thinking. Is that just my imagination, or is it real that we can develop these communication pathways without, you know, voice?
Most of these animals, like dogs and birds, have a vocabulary around 30 words.
30 words.
About 30 words. And so here's a chicken, saying, "There is an intruder approaching me at ground level." Here is the word, I've learnt it. And is a different word for an intruder coming in from the sky, like an eagle.
Right.
And so dogs have got a bunch of words, and you can get up a decent communication with them, and they will tilt their heads ever so endearingly. And it might be because they've got a long muzzle, which normally blocks out their view of your face, or we don't know for the full story.
Fat tells. We all worry about fat. Well, one thing I want to know is it true that you have a certain number, a fixed number of fat cells, and they just grow in size, or is that a load of rubbish? When you lose fat, do you lose
true the above the hips?
Really?
Untrue below the hips.
Ah.
Above the hips, the fat cells get bigger. Below the hips, you can lay down new fat cells. They increase in number.
Oh, but they don't diminish in number.
They can, but you've got to take them through 10 years. They're really robust because their job, the white fat cells, is to keep you alive when times are bad. And that's a very strong evolutionary imperative. So you can do it, but you've got to be rigorous about your diet for 10 years, and then the numbers will go down.
Right, okay. You also talk about insects, and at the moment in Melbourne, I don't know if it's the same in Sydney, there's heaps of mosquitoes around.
Mm.
There's insects everywhere. I want to know why they're attracted to men who drink beer.
We don't know why, but there's something about the smell that is more attractive to the insect. We don't know why, but we know that it is true. And so the cure for that is to, I'm sorry to break your heart, drink less beer.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to break your heart. But also they're attracted to individual smells from various people. So it might be your immune system or your diet. And what you can do is change your diet. So if you're Mediterranean, go across to Chinese. If you're Chinese, go to African. And that might help. But the thing is that there are advantages with staying with your ethnic diet from your ethnic origins, because the bacteria that you have that break down the food have come in a chain down that pathway. They could have changed along the way. So it's a sort of a soft bit of advice.
Okay. And one last question, Dr. Carl, when you're talking about vomiting in your book, it's a fascinating book. We've got to get it. It's you talk about the pressure difference between the stomach and the lungs being for the propulsion out.
Yeah.
Why is it that if I'm walking down the street and I see something like dog poo, I start dry reaching as though I'm going to vomit? So how does that work? Because I haven't got anything bad in my stomach that I want to exit my body.
It's the evolutionary imperative again. Imagine that we're not in a agricultural, highly technological society. We're 20,000 years ago, and we're wandering around in a different part of the planet, and there's some red berries. And so poor Betty goes over and has some of the red berries before, and she's just having some before we've got to them. And then she has 10, and then you and I, we each have one, and then she starts vomiting. That sets off a signal wired over hundreds of thousands of years. Betty, love Betty, too bad she's dead. She's going to die. But by her vomiting, she's going to tell us that we should also vomit, and if we're only if we had only one, we've got a high chance of surviving. So it's a way of protecting the tribe.
Right.
So that way, you have accidentally invoked this in an unnecessary way. You should be able to just walk past it and not vomit. In my particular case, what I did was follow the example of Gandhi, who said, "Be the change that you want to be." And decades ago in my area, I went around on the streets with a plastic bag picking up all the dog poo. And people would say, "Why are you picking up the dog poo?" "So that it won't be there for my feet to get in and bring in track to the house." But say, "But it's not your dog." And I said, "But I can still walk in the dog poo. I don't have a dog, so I'll pick it up." And after about 8 years, people in the area started picking up the dog poo from their own dogs.
So behavioural change.
Yeah, but by being the example.
Yep.
And so in the School of Physics, I'm the toilet fairy, and so I've got a whole lot of gloves, and in the first few weeks of each academic year, the students come in and say, "Hey, I'm not at high school anymore. I can urinate anywhere I want. I don't have to lift up the toilet seat." And so I just go in there and I wipe the toilet seat and I put on the gloves and wipe with the paper and then flush it away. And the students come in and say, "Dr. Carr, why are you doing it?" I said, "Oh, so it's clean for the next person." And then by being the change, the example follows.
Dr. Carl, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you in the studio.
Oh, shucks, Dr. Warren. Thank you.
Thank you.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.